As you remember, we ended up on Thursday running a little experiment. Over the weekend, I analyzed the results of that experiment, and we'll have a little talk about what I found. In 305 and 503, there are two apparently contradictory rules here. One is I encourage you to work in groups, which isn't really contradictory, but in particular, I suggested that you get together with somebody else and exchange programs and test each other's programs and then discuss the results and take the analysis that you got and revise your program appropriately if you need to do that. Sometimes you don't. But on the other hand, I also said that I consider cheating to be handing in work that isn't a result of your own efforts. And those appear to be contradictory. In fact, someone asked the question, is it possible to analyze somebody else? Well, actually, somebody didn't ask a question, asked this question. They asked a question which I reduced to this. Is it possible to analyze somebody else's program and then revise your own without cheating? I mean, that seems to be the crux of the contradiction here. My argument was, yes, it is. It's quite possible. In fact, it's impossible to do the otherwise. It's not possible to remember enough detail so that you can reproduce in your program the characteristics of the analyst program so that you would get caught cheating. But perhaps that's something we should, and you know, I have some intuition behind that, which I guess I talk about later on, that might have been something that we could test. But my argument was, yes, you can. It is, in fact, possible to bring to your own work only the things you can remember about somebody else's work. If you do that, then by your limited memory capabilities, which is not a consequence of you personally, but the fact that you're a human being, with your cognitive mechanisms. Anybody take psychology? Okay, so you should be familiar with some of this stuff a little bit. Although we are not going to talk about 7 plus or minus 2. And that's essentially what I consider learning to be. Learning is stuffing things in your head so that you can pull them out later and use them. Now, of course, this is only first-order learning. There's other kinds of higher-order learning that's very important. But certainly, as a first cut, that's a really good definition of learning, and that's my base-level anticipation of what you are actually going to do in this class. Now we come to the question, or as they say in the experimental world, the hypothesis. Is it possible to remember enough of a program, to be able to reproduce it with high fidelity? My hypothesis, or I believe as they call it, the null hypothesis, was in general, no, that's not possible. It's not something you need to worry about. And as I said, there are a couple of justifications. There's a lot of justifications for that. But as far as I'm concerned, there are two. First of all, there's too much detail for most human memory to take in. It's not possible for you to remember in sufficient detail enough to be able to reproduce somebody else's program in your own. But, of course, you could raise your hand and say, anybody see paper chase? What about photographic memory? There are people who can look at something and remember every detail, for example, the Manhattan phone book, and remember everything they've seen at a glance. What about those people? Okay, so if you happen to have photographic memory, I would still argue that you cannot reproduce perfectly what's going on, because in addition to stuffing stuff into your head, which is, if you have photographic memory, easy to do, you have to take it back out again and use it. And that's the hard part, and photographic memory doesn't help you there. Okay, if you saw the paper chase, you know that there's a character. Paper chase is about people in law school. And there was one character who had photographic memory, so he could just look at case law, just flip through it, and remember everything he saw. The problem was, and the reason he eventually failed, was he didn't know what to do with it once it was in his head. All right, so that's why education is two things, stuffing it into your head, then taking it back out and using it. So these are my two justifications for assuming that it's not going to be a problem. But, like I said, maybe we could test that. So let's do a little experiment, which is what we did the final half hour on Thursday. Just to recall, two people wrote a binary search program. In fact, everybody wrote a binary search program. Each person analyzed another person's program for correctness. Each person then explained their analysis to the other. This is the part where you exchange information. And then finally, each person rewrites their own program based on the analysis that they got from their partner. The question then is, how similar is each person's rewritten program to the other person's original program? That's the experiment we ran. Here's a picture of it. You can tell this is official because they have a 2x2 matrix. Whenever you see a 2x2 matrix, you're on the right track. So you have two people per group, A and B. Each person does two things. They write a program. They write the first program, pre-analysis program. Then they go through an analysis and an exchange of information. And then they write a second program, which is post-analysis. So now we have four programs per group. And what we want to do is we want to compare the revised post-analysis program with the program from which the person that wrote this program did their analysis. So in other words, they looked at person A rewrote this program, rewrote their program after looking at person B's program. Right? And that's the question. So if that's the case, how similar are these two programs? Now, there's actually something interesting here if you think about that protocol. What is it? This experiment, as an experiment, you all took, what is it, SC100, right? So you should all know why this experiment is terrible. There are many ways in which this experiment is terrible. But there's a particular one here, and what is it? Well, what's the objective? What are we looking for? What question are we trying to answer?
If you can replicate from memory.
Exactly, but replicate what?
Another person's data.
Right, and why are we worried about this? It's cheating, exactly. So what we're worried about is cheating on the assignment. Now, when we think about the assignment, what are we actually looking at? What am I looking at? When I say I, since I'm the one who will be on the opposing side of this.
When you're looking for cheating?
Yeah, what are we looking for? What am I comparing when I'm looking for cheating?
I guess you'd look through, find the code to see if the...
Yeah, well, we'll talk about that, but just more generally. Right, but how am I going to do that? What am I going to be looking at? The first problem here is I'm going to be looking at submitted programs, right? So looking, doing this cross analysis is useless because, in fact, I'm not going to have access to these programs. I'm only going to have access to this program. Right, so even if this experiment shows anything useful, it's not going to be very helpful because it's not covering the situation as it actually exists. So that's one of the reasons why this experiment isn't very good. We don't care, or at least I don't care. It's close enough for what we want to show, or what I want to show. All right, so this is the experiment. This is what it looks like. What happened? These are just pulled at random. When I grouped people up, I went from left to right across the room. These are just pulled out of the pile at random, so there's no order here that you can imply by looking at this, unless, of course, you want to say, oh, that's my program, which is up to you to decide. I have not identified anybody here. These are the two original programs that were written before analysis. These are the two programs that were written after analysis. And in this case, the analysis is easy. What we want to do is we want to compare this program with this program and this program with this one to see how similar they are. Okay, well, as I said, in this case, it's simple. These two programs are unchanged. Now, if we assume, which is another problem, that there was no cheating going on in the construction of the original programs, then we're done, right? Because these two are independent, and they're unchanged, so these two are clearly independent. Now, this isn't a very interesting result, but there it is. And the other thing to point out is that both of these programs are wrong. So if you're actually going to spend the time to, you know, go through analysis and take up somebody else's time to ask them to look at your code, you should really pay attention to what they say, first of all. Otherwise, you're not going to do any, I mean, what's the point? Save time and just go watch TV. So this was the first result of the first one. Second one, all right, so apparently I don't know how to make the slide go slightly smaller. So down here it says, I forget what it said. What does it say? This program is unchanged, and this one actually changed from, well, I suppose we could just look at it and see. This one changed from here to here. I'm sorry. This program changed from here to here, presumably under the influence of this program and the analysis of this programmer. But they're still different. Clearly, they're both different. This program actually has an interesting property. Anybody see what it is? We'll come to, actually, this program's interesting property at the end. Oh, there it is, unchanged and different. Sample 3. These two programs also have an interesting property, and what is it? It took me a while to understand what I was looking at because I could not believe I was looking at it. What is the interesting property associated with these two programs? Yes?
There's no loop.
There's no loop. We're supposed to be searching an array, and two people submitted code that don't have loops. Now, this is interesting because, as I mentioned, I guess you brought it up, how do you look for cheaters? Right? There's a lot of different ways to look for cheaters, and I haven't really told you how I'm doing it. I'm just telling you that I've done it. In fact, I will do it. But one of the interesting ways to look for cheaters is not to look at the programs that pass, but to look at the programs that fail. And the reason, why would you do that? That seems kind of counterintuitive. But why would you look at the programs that fail in order to find cheaters?
Because two programs that fail, obviously one of them, if they look similar, they both fail. It's like if one would fail and that guy cheated from the one who failed, he's also going to fail because they both have the same code.
Exactly. But why is that? I mean, you're right. Now you just got to take that last step. Why is that a useful thing to observe? Because I could do the same thing if two programs pass, right? If two programs pass, I can make the same argument. But there is, in fact, a stronger argument you can make for your case. What is it?
I have it in my head. I just don't remember.
Okay.
Well, if you cheated, you obviously didn't know what you were doing and didn't bother to check the code.
That relies on too many assumptions, I think.
Can you say the exact same error?
Yes. Like, for example, here, two people did not put loops in programs to check arrays. We need to answer this question. That's right. Now, do you have a?
I guess not following the directions even.
We'll get to that. But that's unfortunately, I can't really do much with people who don't follow directions.
I mean, if two people pass, most likely their code is going to be kind of similar.
And that's right. What's the other half of that argument? That takes care of the part where you're looking at two programs that pass. Now we have to take care of his case where you're looking at two programs that fail. What's that? You've taken a half step. Now you need to take the other half step.
There's a lot of ways to fail.
Exactly. There's essentially, your argument is, you know, all passing programs are more or less the same. And, you know, we could argue that point. But, you know, to a first approximation, you're right. There are an infinity of ways to get things wrong. So if I look at two programs that don't work and I see that they're failing in more or less the same way, well, that's a really good indication that something more than just plain luck or bad luck is going on. We could also argue against that point, but again, the arguments, you know, would be interesting and probably not definitive. In this case, if I saw something like this, I would say, you know, there's got to be cheating going on here, I think. Maybe there's cheating, maybe there's not. I mean, we have two people who are so unfortunate that they got paired together and didn't believe that you needed to use a loop to do a search through an array. If I see stuff like this, this is a definite red flag. And this code is completely unsuccessful at what it's supposed to be doing. Right. So this is the kind of thing that, among the many things I would be looking for when I would be looking for cheaters. Another thing, again, if you're going to go through the effort to actually do all this stuff, make sure it pays off. I mean, these people are lost in the woods, and it doesn't seem like they have any direction on how to get out. Sample 4, if we take a look, this program is significantly different from this one. Similarly, in this direction. All right, so again, I don't think you have to worry too much about cheating here. On the other hand, there are a few things you need to worry about. For example, if you look at this program, right, you can pretty much see what's wrong. And then you look at this program, and you look at these two programs, and the question is, how do you go from here through here to there? In particular, what is this stuff? What's going on here? So here's an example of where you can get something wrong, and this is, you know, way far away from what you would expect to get. So I don't know what's going on here either, but the point is, this is not something we have to worry about. The only thing we have to worry about is, can we tell the difference between this program and this program? And the answer is pretty clear. Yes, we can. And same way in the other direction. Sample 5, notice that very little learning went on in this direction. Essentially, these two are, well, actually some small amount. We did actually go from no loop to loop here, so that's not too bad. But And that may be just a function of I only gave you 5 minutes, which we'll talk about later. But clearly this program is different from that one. So again, differences, not a problem. Sample 6. Oh, I don't even see. Oh, that's right. This program was too big, so I didn't actually put whether they were too. Both of these are different. I guess there's not much to say. Again, notice that there was apparently some small amount of learning going on from here to here. Not so much from here to here. But again, if you compare crosswise, they are clearly different. Last sample, they're both different. All right, so that was there were 14 people, that's 7 groups. That's the data set from our little experiment. So what are the results of that little test? What can we conclude? None of the revised programs were close to the partner's original program. All right, so the issue of cheating, at least in the way that I recommend that things go, is not a problem, really. There is little danger of being accused of cheating, at least for these results. Now, of course, as they say, your mileage may vary. If you remember, I don't know if they talk about this in Introduction to Science or whatever it's called, but you have to worry about threats to validity of your experiments, and there's, as I mentioned earlier, huge numbers of threats of validity. In particular, the time pressure, the fact that you're limited to 5 minutes is a big problem. But on the other hand, this was just sort of an informal, what's known in the software engineering biz as a spike test, just to make sure very quickly and thoroughly whether or not you had anything worth pursuing. And perhaps we do. So that's it. The results of the experiment were essentially, I don't think you really have to worry about being able to recover enough information to produce with troublesome fidelity someone else's program. Now you can do with that what you will. There are some other observations to make. This turns out to be a sort of a gold mine of things, of information. So there are people wrote 14 programs. 14 people wrote 14 programs. The first interesting thing is the instructions were to implement a binary search. No one did that. Everyone implemented linear search, which is not good. This one is even more distressing. All but one of the programs didn't work. That was the, I mentioned back in the second example, there is something interesting about that program on the left. The interesting thing about that program was it was the only correct program. That is actually not funny. No. You are not really going to get out of this class alive if this is the way you program. Red, this is Q1. This is, does the program work with an empty array? An empty array, does the program work? Q2, does the program work with a non-empty array when X is in the array? And Q3, does the program work when the array is non-empty and X is not in the array? Okay, red means no, green means yes. Yellow means yes, you passed, but the reason you passed is by sheer luck. And in particular, most of these yellow squares, if there is actually something I didn't really understand here. Let's see if I can find an example of it. That's a complicated example. Oh, here's a good example. What's interesting about this program, apart from the fact that it doesn't work? All right, let me ask the question a little bit more precisely. Why doesn't this program work? Yes?
I never set a value to I.
Oh, you're right. That's a bad example. Yes, you're right. But all right, let's try this one. Why doesn't this program work? You're right. But that wasn't actually what I wanted to.
It's just one.
Oh, that, we don't care. That's syntax. We don't care about that. I mean, the idea is more or less we understand that. Or let's put it this way. I'm willing to give that one for free. There's something fundamentally wrong with this program.
This squiggly Johns?
Sorry? No. I don't care about that. I mean, you got to remember, I didn't ask you to compile this code, so, you know, syntactical things I'm not interested in.
The returns inside the loop.
Exactly. How many times does this go through the loop? Once, right? So that's why, and either it returns the first value or it returns minus one. All right, so this program is going to fail on Q2 every time, unless the X is the first element in the array, this program is going to fail. On the other hand, it's going to actually pass on Q3. Right? That's the test in which the array is non-empty and does not contain X. Because the first time through, it's going to say, oh, minus 1, which is correct, but unfortunately the program didn't know that. So that's why there are yellow things here. Yellow was like, yeah, they got it correct, but it was just by merest luck that it was correct. These should actually be red. Right, that is not real good. All kinds of errors occurred, in particular non-looping code. We had some examples of that. Indexing exceptions, I'll talk about that on the next slide. Uninitialized indexes, which I guess is what you pointed out, at least on one of the programs. There were two other ones. Truncated iterations, stopping too short, which someone pointed out. Wrong return value, oh, that was one of them. This one, I suppose I should have pointed out. What's interesting about this program? Yes?
The returns in the array?
I'm sorry, what was
The return is in the loop.
That's true. But there's something else actually interesting about this program.
It's returning a string.
Exactly. It's returning a string. First of all, it's not what I asked for. Secondly, I mean, it doesn't make any sense, right? I mean, it doesn't, you just look at it and you say, how does this make sense? I point this out as we'll go into more excruciating detail when your first assignment is out, because this is particularly bad. Because I use automated tools to test your code. Right. And if you do things that I don't ask you to do, it's almost certain that your code's going to fail because I'm looking for something or my code is looking for something and you're not giving it that. So it says, oops, I didn't see what I expected, X. Right. So if you do things like this, then your code is not going to, it's going to fail automatically and immediately. So that's what this was, wrong return value. Early termination. Again, we'll talk about that on the next slide. Skipping elements was another one. These are the counts on the revised programs, except for this one where there were 5 original programs that didn't have any loops in them. And then after revision, 4 of them were fixed, and then one of them still maintained no loop in their revision. And then there are lots of other things like syntax errors and curly bracket errors. But again, that's just syntax. We don't really care about that, particularly since I didn't ask you to compile your code. You could come up with arguments for some of these, you know, about, and this goes back to the threats for validity of the experiment, but there are a couple of things for which it's much, much harder to justify, and that is what's known as fence post errors. Did they talk about fence post errors in 175, 176? Anybody know what a fence post error is? If I want to have a 10-foot fence and I want to have fence posts at every foot, how many fence posts do I need?
9.
Anybody else?
11.
I want to have a fence that's 10 feet long and I want to have a fence post at every foot. How many fence posts do I need to buy at Home Depot or whatever they have these days? 11? 9? Anybody else? 8?
10.
Okay, so we've gone from 8 to 11. Right, and the correct answer is, of course, 11. The normal answer is, well, you have 10 feet, you need a fence post every foot, you need 10 fence posts. But, of course, you're forgetting you need one at both ends. Right? And that's why it's called a fence post error. Another name for the error is off by 1. Right? And you can be off by 1 in 2 ways. You can have too many. You can have 12. Or you can have too few. You can have 10. Right? And here's an example of code in which you had too many elements. Right? I have an n-element array. I want to go through every element and check to make sure it's some value. How many times do I have to do that? It's not n, which is what this code says. It's n minus 1. And the reason for that is you start counting at 0. So if you write code like this to go through the array, you're going to throw an exception when you hit I equals the length of the array. And this is one of the nice things. This is probably the only thing I like about Java as opposed to C++. Of course, if this is C++ code, it'll just do it. So this is extra hard to find in students' code. But, of course, in Java, this will throw an exception and your program bombs. The other problem is looking at too few elements. Right, this person was sort of right. They didn't want to go up to a.length or n. Right? So they wanted to go up to but not include the a.len. But then they took, just to be safe, they took one away, just to make sure. But, of course, now they're stopping too early. So if the last element in the array was x, this code would not find it. These errors are inexcusable. To a certain extent, you have to be a little careful because these are mistakes. I mean, I still make these mistakes. I still make fence post errors, particularly when I'm not paying very close attention. So that's why I'm pointing these out, not because these mistakes were made, because you're going to make them, unless you're a superior being, which some of you might be, who knows. I'm not. I make fence post errors all the time. So what you need to do is you need to sensitize yourself to the possibility of making a fence post error and check for them. And let's see, we have software engineers here, right? Who's the software engineer? Do they still use PSP? No, I guess the answer is no then. That stands for personal software process. I think it's a real joke, but they used to use it. I'm not sure when they teach it in the program. What are you, a senior? Sophomore.
My friends are in it right now, so I'm behind. They're in junior year, they teach it.
And they're doing PSP?
Yeah.
Okay, PSP is personal software process, and essentially it's an exercise in self-awareness. What you need to do is you need to become self-aware about the kinds of activities you perform when you perform programming or coding or whatever, design. Okay, now I think that's a great idea. What I disagree with is the way that PSP does it, which is heavily based on all kinds of essentially pointless metrics, and that's my point of view, I should say. The point here is, you need to check for these and find them before the compiler does. Because, of course, the compiler is going to find this, but it's not going to find this for you. And, of course, this is exactly where I'm going to look. When I write tests, these are the first tests I write, is tests to find out fence post errors. Okay, in summary, so I suppose we can conclude, and because it's my experiment, I can conclude this. Experiment supports the claim that it's unlikely that humans can remember enough detail to reproduce a program with high fidelity. Particularly, I told you that was another threat to the validity of the experiment. I pretty much told you the result we're looking for. Okay, so that's another reason why this experiment is completely stupid. On the other hand, it still supported my claim. Again, the point here is the objective is to understand things, not to reproduce them. If you can understand something, you can automatically reproduce it. Not the other way around. If you can reproduce something, you don't necessarily understand it, which is why I define cheating the way I did. Pick the most tenacious study partner you can find. You want to have somebody who is just going to hammer you over and over again, and is happy to do it. So you want tenacious, another word for tenacious, of course, is sadistic. Because they are the ones who will actually take the time to run you through the ropes and make sure that your program works. And, of course, you get to reciprocate, so it's not that bad. If you can't find somebody who's tenacious, find somebody who's smart. And I have a bias towards tenacious people as opposed to smart people, because smart people may be hard to understand them. Right? They may not be able to communicate very well and so forth and so on. So look for a tenacious person, and if you can't find them, look for a smart person. And, of course, you yourself should be both tenacious and smart. That's it. Any questions? I graded these, or I went through them on Friday, and it essentially sent me into a tailspin for the rest of the weekend. I was so depressed. This is not a good result. This is not the level of programming you can bring into this course. I don't know how to step it up for you. But if this is the way you program, then you're not going to pass this class. It's as simple as that. All right, so now we're going to go back to where we were interrupted on Thursday and finish up talking about abstract data types, which we were supposed to be covering on Thursday. And then we'll move on to the topic of this week's lecture on Tuesday, interfaces, and then on Thursday, generics. So let's see. Where were we? So we started talking about abstract data types. And the relationship, actually, did we get that far? I don't know. We'll find out. So I started off by looking at arrays. And we picked arrays apart for various reasons, principally, at least with respect to this slide, or with respect to this lecture, is to figure out what kind of properties arrays have, and in particular, what kind of operations you can perform on arrays. And we will justify the obsession with operations. So we talked about arrays, some of their properties, some of their operations. Here's an example of an array. What is this? Oh, this is the collapse thing. Maybe I should have put linear search in here. And then we went on to talk about classes. This should be review. You should, again, have experience with classes from your previous, I guess I can't say classes, should I? From your previous courses. Here's an example of a class. And we talked about methods, which are the operations that we perform on things, constructors, default constructors, instance variables, blah, blah, blah. So this is all just, again, should be review. Instance variable initialization, man, a lot of junk. And then we moved on to abstract data types. So we defined an abstract data type pretty much the same way we defined a class. It is a collection of data and operations on the data. And then we defined the notion of an interface for an ADT. And that essentially, so one of the things I said was classes and ADTs, what's the difference? I mean, for the most part, they sound like they're the same. And one of the things I said was, well, we can define this strong partition between the things that are available outside the ADT and the things that are accessible from the inside. And it's that strong partition is one of the things that separates classes from ADTs. We'll see some more today. The interface lists all the operations that are accessible outside the ADT to the clients. I don't know if I introduced that term or not yet. Then we went on to categorize the kinds of operations or methods you would see in the interface as being either maintenance operations, manipulation operations, and query operations. The difference being, well, what is the difference between the three? How would you characterize operations in each one of those categories?
Like queries, like searching.
Okay. Could you be, yeah, but so that's an example. Could you tell me what the broader class of queries would be? Why did you put searching in queries as opposed to maintenance?
Because maintenance would be, I guess, changing something as opposed to, I don't know.
Okay. Well, you're sort of on the right track. Anybody else? Well, the easiest way to think about it is queries are read-only operations. Okay, and query is read-only operations. Manipulators are read-write, so you're sort of on the right track. And that leaves us with maintenance. Well, what's maintenance? Maintenance is also a read-write, so from that point of view, it's a manipulation operation, but what other kinds of characteristics does a maintenance operation have that separates it from manipulation? Because you could think of it as being a manipulation operation. And if that's the case, then why do we have an extra category? Why don't we just have the two? Yes?
Changes the function of the ADT? Or changes what it does?
I think I will say no for that, unless you care to explain further.
No, I was just
okay.
manipulation just changes the elements.
Right.
And maintenance changes the array itself.
Changes the internals of the abstract data type. Right. So in some sense, maintenance is more fundamental. And I don't know, I think I mentioned that someplace. That's where we stopped. Yes, manipulation operates on the state, the thing represented. Maintenance operates on the representation itself. That turns out to be important principally for the constructors, which is I don't believe we're going to be talking about any data structures that have any other significant maintenance operations, although once you get into it and start writing real-life abstract data types, then you will have non-trivial maintenance operations, but we're not going to cover that here. So that's where we stop. Any questions about what we talked about on Thursday up to the experiment? All right, so here's an example of an ADT. We have at least one ADT, and this one certainly looks like another one, and you can certainly think of it that way. So what we have are the ADT itself, and then we have the operations that are visible at the interface. You remember I said there's this partition, which you can see fairly clearly. Actually, I suppose I could have drawn a dotted line here to indicate a partition, but then there's probably too much on this picture already. The only thing that's visible outside the ADT to what are known as the clients are these methods that are poking through the interface. Everything else is hidden, and inside we have, you could have lots of other things, which we're not going to talk about in this class. Actually, that's not quite true, I guess. When we get to linked lists, we'll talk about some other things, but we can leave it go for now. Now we have more methods or operations on the inside, and then we have the state, the representation of whatever it is we're dealing with, whatever it is the ADT is modeling. And then, of course, we have a whole bunch of lines all over the place to indicate the relationship between access. And this is the principal thing we're interested in, is control of access, although I'm not going to actually harp on that too much. And then the client, of course, has only access to the external operations on the ADT. But notice that the internal operations in this client can also access external operations of some other ADT. So it's a fairly flexible way to implement things. So now I've introduced abstract data, and we're going to come back to this. This is going to be true for everything we talk about in the first section. I'm going to give you a pretty much bare bones description of what it is we're going to be dealing with, and then I'm going to come back to it and add pieces to it as we go along. I don't know that that's a good thing to do, but it's something I usually don't do. Usually I just like say, here's everything you need to know, and dump it on you, and then we go on to the next thing. But I'm trying something different this semester, so we'll see how it works. So that's at least as far as we're going to go with respect to ADTs and classes. Any questions about that? So I have a question, which is actually kind of unfair to ask. It's like, what's the point? I said that classes are pretty much ADT, so why introduce two separate concepts? Why not have a single concept and, again, get rid of something that you don't need? Well, there's lots of reasons why. First of all, ADTs are a concept. Classes are an implementation. ADTs are how you can think about something, but not necessarily implement it. Classes are how you can implement something. ADTs provide stronger access guarantees than do classes. Okay? And again, of course, this depends on what classes you're looking at. If you're looking at some languages like Smalltalk, then essentially a class is an ADT. Well, that's actually not quite true, but for our purposes it is. Okay, but if you're looking at something like Java, that is certainly not the case. Classes are really porous in Java, and that's part of the problem. ADTs got there first. ADTs were a concept that was developed in the late 60s and continued to be developed through the 70s and even into the 80s, where it got killed essentially by object-oriented programming. So they were there first, but they did not win the race. Another example of technological superiority failing in the marketplace. ADTs are simpler than classes, and this is the other reason why I'm introducing this. There is a lot of complexity associated with Java classes, and I'm going to essentially avoid almost all of that complexity by treating them as if they were ADTs. In particular, what that means is I'm not going to talk about inheritance. We're not going to actually be dealing with inheritance in this class very much. So one way to think about it is ADTs are of objects, but are not objects in and of themselves. All right, so with that in mind, let's go and go back to our original, which, if you remember, all the way back to last Thursday, was arrays. We sat there and we thought about arrays. So let's try and figure out what arrays can do, and I think we did this already, so I'm just going to go through this fairly quickly. What kind of operations does an array support? Again, maintenance operations, we want to be able to create an array, and let us assume we might want to be able to free it explicitly, as opposed to Java, which is implicit, and maybe do some resizing, things like that. Query operations, we want to get a value, we want to read a value from the array, figure out how many elements are in the array, so forth and so on. And manipulation, we want to be able to put an element into an array. We might be able to want to be able to, given two indices, swap the elements of those two indices. That turns out to be a useful thing to have in your array. Okay, the important thing to note here is that there's no information about how the array is implemented. This is a manifestation of that interface I was talking about. There's a strong separation between what's inside the ADT and what is outside and accessible to the client. There is no data outside an ADT accessible to the client. This, again, is a significant difference from Java, which is not the case, although, of course, you can make it be so. In other words, just the operations it supports. With that in mind, we can go and create an array ADT using a class. And in this case, it looks just like a class, because it is a class. But the point here is we want it to be an ADT. Okay. Now, one of the things we're going to do in the rest of this week and as we go along is make our classes look more like ADTs. Right now, it looks just like a class. I'm sorry. I said that backwards, didn't I? What we're going to do as we go along is make our ADTs look less like a class and more like an ADT. Right now, the ADT looks exactly like a class because we don't have anything other than classes that we've talked about so far. So in summary, in conclusion, classes group data and operations into an organized unit. Abstract data types also group data and data operations into an organized unit, but they have stronger guarantees on the access relationships. They have a simpler organization than classes, and they also have a simpler structure, which we're not going to talk about here. Abstract data types are a concept, and classes are an implementation, which is something you should probably hold on to as you begin to flounder and trying to understand what the difference between the two of those are. Questions? All right, so that brings us to today's lecture, which are all about interfaces. You notice I talked about interfaces previously with respect to ADTs as that partition between inside and outside. Now what we're going to do is realize that, at least as much as we can in Java. Now we're going to be talking about Java things in addition to ADT things. So essentially what we'll do is we'll first go back to this idea of describing ADTs in terms of classes and then introduce the notion of interfaces. And I suppose I did not choose names wisely. Maybe I should have said partition with respect to ADTs, but I hope it won't get too confusing. This is our array ADT. It looks just like a class. This is the same as it was on the previous slides. So what's wrong with that? You're done. You have a class. Well, we're done. Who could possibly object to having a class? Well, there's a number of objections you could make. First of all, the class contains too much information that is uninteresting to the clients. Uninteresting because the clients can't get at it. I mean, if we take a look here, even if we just look at this sort of schematic definition of a class implementation of an array, in particular, we have the actual implementations of the methods. Well, the clients don't care. They just want to know how to call the individual public methods. Actually, I suppose I should have put public here, but I didn't, so oh well. In other words, what are the arguments, what are the types of the arguments, and what do I get back when I call it? That's the only thing the client needs to know. All the other stuff that you can see when you look at a class is not relevant to the client. Of course, it's relevant to the implementer of that class, but not to the client. So things like implementation details, non-public methods, package default and protected and so forth, and private for that matter. Another important point, which is sort of the topic of what we're going to be talking about today, is are arrays the only thing that behave like arrays? Is array-like behavior unique? And I suppose the first question we should ask is, what is array-like behavior?
Storing multiple elements and being able to sort them and access them individually.
Right. Can you give me a more concise... That's true. Can you give me a more concise and, in fact, more complete description of what array-like behavior is?
Probably not.
Okay.
To be honest,
anybody else? Well, it's what we just saw over here. That gives you what array-like behavior is. Whatever is accessible outside that class is what arrays can do. So the interface, and I guess I shouldn't say that now because that's now overloaded. The set of visible methods on a class are define what array-like behavior is. And the question is that unique? Is there another data structure that exhibits this kind of behavior? And to a certain extent, I guess that question is unfair since I'm assuming information that we haven't gone over yet. But just in case anybody's read ahead, are there other things that we would like to treat as arrays? No one's read ahead. Okay, so the answer is yes, there are. So other array-like classes have to be dealt with separately. But we would actually, since they all behave more or less the same, we'd like to be able to treat them as a group so we don't have to remember all these different things. So the question, and of course there's lots of other things wrong, but these are the two principal ones that we're going to deal with here. Is there a client-friendly way to specify the important parts of a class? And is there a way to specify array-like behavior without specifying an array itself? That's the question we want to be able to, these two questions are the ones we want to be able to deal with. Because these are going to serve to motivate our introduction of the data structures that are going to follow as we go along through the course. And the answer, of course, I've already given, that's yes, that's this partition that an abstract data type defines between the private and the public parts of a particular data type. So an interface specifies a class's allowable operations. Right? And in particular, it specifies them, it doesn't define them. Right? So that's getting rid of information. I don't really care how you implement these operations, I just want to know what they are. All the methods in an interface are non-static and public. An interface can contain other things, variables, classes, other interfaces. We're not going to talk about that, but that actually can happen. Here's an example of an interface. You just take the class keyword and replace it by interface. And in fact, that extends. So all the little modifiers that we talked about with respect to classes, I shouldn't say all of them, that's not quite true. Most of the modifiers that we talked about with respect to classes also apply to interfaces. I think we'll see a couple of them as we go along. So we're defining an array ADT interface here. And then we define the methods that are available to operate on an ADT. And notice that they're all public and they're all non-static. They tell you what the arguments are. Two integers, one of which you can sort of interpret as an index, and the other of which you can sort of interpret as a value. Naturally, you'd actually need to specify more in the form of documentation, JavaDoc probably. The other thing to note here is that there is no implementation. We don't know how put is implemented. Right? We don't know how get is implemented. Because that is something, as a user of an ADT, we don't care about. So this gives us our first advantage. We can now concentrate directly on the things that are important to the client and not have to worry about anything else. Yes?
So it tells you like the names of the methods, not how they work?
Yes, exactly. The names of the methods and not how they work, which is a problem. In fact, when I talk about object-oriented programming languages, that's what I call the great lie. Right? Because if you look at this and it says put, well, it says, yeah, I think I know how it works. But there's no guarantee. Because this can be implemented to do arbitrary things. I mean, when you call put, it could launch the missiles. That's perfectly acceptable. And there's no way that you can guarantee that. Now, people like to pretend that there is, but that's just a pretense. But that's not for this class. All right, so now, having introduced the idea of it, yes, sorry.
So where is the code that tells you what each of those do?
That's this slide right here. Now what we need to do is we need to actually answer that question. How do we provide? Notice that the only thing I need as a client is this. Right? You give a client this and the client is happy. They know essentially the syntax of the method calls. and they know the method calls themselves. Now the client can do work independent of what you do as an implementer. That turns out to be important when you're doing system development, because that essentially allows you to break the structure of the system up to independent pieces that are bridged by these interfaces, at least in theory anyway. It turns out to be a little bit harder than that in practice, but we don't have to worry about that. So how do we combine them now? We've broken them apart. How do we combine them? And essentially, you use the implements relationship between interfaces and classes. Okay? Have people been introduced to the implements relationship in whatever it is? Okay, so everybody's, all right, good. So a class implements one or more interfaces. So we have a class custom array, which implements the array ADT. This is a promise. This says that I will provide to you, the client of this custom array, the methods as defined in the array ADT. You can now define the individual methods, and in fact, you must define all of them in the class, and it's at that point you put the code in. Actually, it doesn't seem like a very big deal, right? Because, I mean, so what? What's essentially the only thing we did was we added this. Because if you get rid of this, then we just have the class that we had in the previous lecture. Is that, do you have a question? Or?
Yeah. Sorry. So when you write that implements it, does that mean that custom array can use the methods that are in the array?
Exactly. And not only that, they can expect those methods to be in custom array. Now, I think I mentioned this later. Well, let me just leave it for now. There are some other things we could talk about. Yes?
So in custom array, you have to define all the...
Exactly. Methods. Now, does anybody know the correct... That's my answer is yes. That answer turns out to be wrong. Does anybody know why that answer is wrong? Okay. Yes? Well, you'd have to tell me what empty methods mean.
I think it just opens and closes.
That would you could use that to, I mean, her question is, can I implement custom array and not have, what was that, git? So can I cross this method off, and is that legal?
Yeah, but only if you implement another, or I should say, you would have to make another class.
Exactly, That's why the correct answer is no. For purposes of this class, the answer is yes. Okay. Because there's something I haven't talked about. What's that called? What's this class called if I don't implement git?
I can't remember.
Okay. Does anybody, do you have a hand up there? Sorry? Yeah. Okay. This will be an abstract class. But we're not going to talk about abstract classes. So the assumption is, if a class implements an interface, then it implements every method in the interface, which makes it a regular class as opposed to an abstract class. All right, so like I said, big deal. So what? Well, we talked about the first thing already. As long as the customer understands what the array ADT is, the customer can immediately use custom array. You can just throw it at them, and they use it. They're done. They don't have to make any changes, assuming they wrote their code correctly as it stands, which, because it's Java, if they didn't, it wouldn't compile. And assuming they understand what the operations are, they don't have to change their code. Right? That's an extremely valuable measure of independence between use and implementation, and that is something that I'm going to stress as we go along, which is why I'm talking about them now. What else is useful? I mean, that in and of itself is an important characteristic of a programming language, particularly when you start talking about programming systems where you are building real things. I should mention that people still don't know how to do this. People are still trying to do, still trying out various features to actually provide that measure of independence, which is one of the reasons why object-oriented programming was so successful. It was the technique that came the closest. It didn't solve the problem by any means, but it came the closest of all the techniques that were around at the time. So what other relationships are there between classes and interfaces? For the most part, we are probably not going to cover the, we're not going to actually deal too much with them, but I'll mention them anyway just in case. A class may implement more than one interface, so you can have actually a class that behaves like two different abstract data types, which turns out to be useful for various reasons. It can implement an interface and extend the class, so you can have a class that's a child of another class, but that child also implements an interface. And you can also add your own methods to a class that implements an interface. So it's not a requirement that you implement just the methods in the interface. You can implement other methods too. But you do have to implement, as far as we're concerned, in this class, all the methods in the interface. The interesting thing, and I sort of hinted at this earlier when I talked about things that can be in an interface, an interface may extend other interfaces. All right. So, for example, I could have, suppose I'm interested in providing not only an abstract data type that looks like an array, but can also be printed. So I can extend the array ADT, which didn't have, at least as far as we could see, a print method on it. And I can just extend that by creating a new interface that extends array and adds the print method. Notice, again, I don't specify how that actually works. Yes?
Now, if custom array were to implement interface printable array, would that include all of the methods from array ADT too?
Exactly. Exactly. This extension behaves just the same way it does with classes. So in other words, you get inheritance. So I guess I lied to you. I said I wasn't going to talk about inheritance, and here I am talking about inheritance. But I'm doing it sort of implicitly. I really hate inheritance. Inheritance is an extraordinarily bad idea, which is why I'm trying to avoid it whenever possible. You can actually do this without inheritance. You can define things so that this works without the idea of inheritance, but that's just completely outside the scope of this course. Any other questions? Okay. Now this, actually, before I do this, let me take attendance. All right, so that's it, I think, for all. That's all we're going to talk about today, anyway, with respect to the relationship between classes and interfaces. Any questions about that? Is anybody surprised by this? Anybody unfamiliar with the things that we've been talking about? Okay, good. Now we're going to talk about something else, which is going to turn out to be important for what we're going to talk about on Thursday. We've defined interfaces, and I said that interfaces are a way to specify the expected behavior of classes, and the combination of the two gives you something that resembles an ADT. Well, you can do other things with interfaces. Something else that you can do with interfaces, and this turns out to be a fairly powerful and important technique in Java. It's something that we're probably not going to spend a lot of time on in this class, which is unfortunate, but we do need to cover some of it, so that's why I'm talking about it now. But this is a technique which, if you really want to call yourself an object-oriented programmer, you need to understand. And I should say that this technique is not unique to Java. There's essentially any programming language you look at that claims to support or be object-oriented should actually give you this capability. And some of them do and some of them don't. The important point here, the additional function that a function is probably a bad word, the additional capability that an interface gives you is it defines a type. Okay, now, I actually had a huge section of this lecture in which I go into types, but I decided to rip it out because dealing with types in Java is a pain. So I will just say type and leave it more or less undefined, at least for now. We will come back to the idea of type on Thursday. The important point here, and another relationship between classes and interfaces in Java, is that a class that implements an interface can be considered to be of the interface's type. And I think you sort of got at that when you asked your question about the relationship between a class that implements the printable array ADT and the array ADT. So what does that mean in pictorial terms? Here's my definition of an ADT. This is my interface, and then I implement an interface as a class, so I realize the ADT. Okay. The relationship between these two things, as I indicated before, is the implements relationship. That's the little tag that you stick in the class when to indicate that you're going to be implementing all the methods that are defined in this interface. The point here is not only is this a custom array, but you can also treat it as an array ADT. So if you create an instance of a custom, if you create an instance of a custom array, you can also think of that as an instance of an array ADT. So in a sense, it has two types. There's the name of the class from which it came, and then there's the name of the interface that that class implements. That's going to be an incredibly useful and incredibly powerful concept that we're going to be exploiting in this class, and as I said, you should be exploiting as an object-oriented programmer. And I believe that's all I'm going to say. That's all I'm going to say about this now. But I just wanted to introduce this concept. Like I said, we'll come back to it on Thursday when we talk about generics. Interfaces also have lots of other uses in Java, but we're not going to be talking about those for the most part in this class. I'm not quite sure, but I'm going to try very hard to avoid it. The other possibility that may come up is using interfaces as providing multiple inheritance in Java. Right, you may have learned, or you probably should have learned in 175, 176, Java does not support multiple inheritance. It differs from C++ in that. But it turns out by implementing multiple ADTs, which is something I talked about earlier tonight, you can provide a sort of multiple inheritance. Like I said, I'm going to try and avoid using this, and I think for the most part I can be successful. But if it comes up again, that will be an example of what I'm talking about. If you don't understand that, don't worry about it. But that's another example of using interfaces that you may have heard of. All right, so again, what's the advantage here? An interface precisely specifies the constituent operations required by a data structure. So in a sense, and this is another way to think about interfaces that's very useful, an interface represents a contract. I said that we have this partition between what's inside inside an ADT and what the users or clients of the ADTs can expect. And I said that partition is the interface. Another way to think about that is that partition is a contract. Right? It specifies to the client what it can expect when it deals with the ADT, and it specifies to the ADT what, sorry, not ADT, class, it specifies to the class what that class must provide. Okay, that turns out to be an extremely powerful way to structure software systems, in particular object-oriented systems. The programming language Eiffel. Anybody familiar with that? That is a language that uses, and you know why? Because I failed. When software engineering, when we were changing over to Java, I was lobbying extremely hard for software engineering to just dump both C++ and Java and take up Eiffel. But they looked at me as if I was an idiot, which perhaps I am. Who knows? I think the only language that really makes sense to teach software engineering in is Eiffel. C++, certainly not C++, and Java, I don't think so, but that didn't go through. But that is a language that uses the idea of a contract to establish relationships between clients and providers. And it turns out to be a really useful way to do things, but we're not going to look at that. So a custom array behaves like an array ADT. Anything that implements the interface array ADT then acts like an array. And like I said, the great lie there is that we assume we know what it means when you call git. But of course, you're at the mercy of the programmer to make sure that's true. That's one of the reasons why contracts are nice. They, to a certain extent, guarantee that. They can't do it very completely, but at least they give you a little bit of help with that. A single interface covers many different but similarly behaved data structures. All right, so now, remember the other objection I had to using classes without this idea of interfaces is we could create a bunch of data structures that are kind of array-like. Right, but I would have to treat them all as individual data structures. Right, there's no sort of overarching concept involved. Now we can use arrays to do that. If each one of those data structures implements the same interface, then by this notion of type, I can treat them all as that interface. Now I can ignore the fact that there's lots of different ones down there until it becomes time to actually pick one, which turns out to be, again, another powerful technique in building systems. So in summary, interfaces specify expected class behaviors, and they specify a data structure's constituent operations in turn, and specify a, sorry, interfaces specify expected class behavior, period, next sentence. Specify a data structure's constituent operations in terms of interface. That's essentially what this means. We are going to be dealing with classes through this idea of an interface. Any questions? This is, and if you actually go to the lecture notes, you'll see a link to this book. The part about using interfaces to define types came from this book, Effective Java. It's not the book that discovered this idea. This has been an idea that's been around for quite some time, but it sort of codifies the notion and explains what it means with respect to Java. It has lots of other examples in it, too. So if you want, you can take a look at that. And that's it, I believe. Yes, that's it. Any questions? All right, if there are no questions, then we're done.